Materiality does not attack the body or the conscious functioning of the mind, it assails the willpower and destroys the morale. As long as there is the desire to fight ignorance and degeneracy, as long as there is the inner urge to resist evil and the illusions of matter, it is possible to attain liberation with reasonable effort. Form, however, fights in an underhanded way by taking away the desire to master its elements, and substituting therefore the lethargy of indifference which prefers to leave things just as they are and go along with the rest of the world, enjoying its momentary pleasures and suffering as resolutely as possible the concurrent ills of life. When the material urge of physical environment has so benumbed the nature that every spiritual aspiration is anesthetized, the individual is reduced to the level of that mediocre throng who are content to struggle along in the age-old ruts. Such have hypnotized themselves into the false belief that existing conditions are inevitable and unchangeable. Tihi Inferior Creation and Its Regent 79. 80 Lectures on ANC and Philosophy. When the desire to do right for the sake of right is smothered by matter, there is left but one power capable of dealing with the problem of inertia, namely, pain, either mental, physical, physical or emotional. Through suffering, the insufficiency of material accomplishments is demonstrated. The desire to do good for the sake of good is an urge far too subtle to survive the stifling influence of matter. Hence, to counteract man's incessant effort to forget his own spiritual needs is his continual proclivity to hurt himself. Man's effort to control his own life without intelligence invariably demonstrates its futility. He strives to live without the help of consciousness, with the result that he exists in pain and tribulation. Because of his suffering, he acquires a great incentive toward knowledge for its own sake in order to save himself from the pain resulting from ignorance. Thus the law of self-preservation is ever forcing the way ward feet back into the path that leads to light. Physical suffering first led man to ponder the mysteries of his own being. In the last analysis, however, the pain of the body is the least poignant. Then came emotional suffering, the pain in the heart, much more desperate and difficult to endure. Lastly came mental suffering, in which the entire constitution is torn and racked by that gargantuan conflict when the faculties of the mind hurl thought missiles at each other. Looking at the average individual, we see a consciousness that is impotent in the grasp of form which, like cold, has benumbed its sensibilities. Cold is the proper symbol of the circumference of the sphere of being. The word hell, derived from the Scandinavian hell, means cold, though it has long been associated with its opposite term, heat. This discloses a certain consistent inconsistency characteristic of the works of man. Some missionaries visiting the far north described in glowing terms the sulfurous nature of hell. As a result, the Eskimos were immediately interested, for the underworld was thereby made particularly inviting to a race that found extreme difficulty in keeping heat in their chilled organisms. Obviously, any intimate description of hell depends for its effectiveness upon the equation of longitude. Tihi Inferior Creation and Its Regent 81. And latitude. Just as life, light, and heat are associated with the quality of expansion, since the natural impulse of life is to expand, so death, darkness, and cold are related to the quality of contraction, since the natural impulse of death is to contract. Realizing, according to the ancient mysteries, that the physical universe was the sphere of death and that there was no death so real as immersion in form, let us now consider the nature and structure of this great dark sphere as it was taught to the philosophers of ancient days, and is still preserved among those groups who are perpetuating the ancient wisdom. The material universe considered as a unit is the body of the Lord of form or the master of the world. This world Lord, whose consciousness is of the nature of mind, is the Jehovah or Ihvh of the Jews, the Zeus of the Greeks, and the Jupiter of the Romans. In the philosophy of the Gnostics and the Neo-Platonists he was called the Demiurgus. The original interpretation of this word is difficult to ascertain, but it may be rendered in its philosophic sense as the false urge. The Demiurgus is therefore to be defined as the composite material universe, considered as a personal being or power. The emanations from this Lord are called his powers, and are sometimes referred to as the princes of the world. You will remember that Jesus warned his disciples that the princes of this world would never understand him, and that they had nothing in common with him. The princes of the world arc the divisions of the forces controlling the form universe, these forces being considered as gods. Philosophically, the Lord of the world is the great autocrat, for autonomy is a principle non-existent in the universal sense. This despot, who is conceived as using the earth for his footstool and the heavens for his throne, is presumed to control his universe through the inexorable justice of law, which because of man's ignorance breeds fear, hate, and death. When you think of the philosophic Trinity, remember that the third person of this triad is the Lord of the world, called the Heartless One because he is the slave driver of the cycle of necessity. He is the terrible ogre or giant of hate, so called, who grinds our bones to make his bread. 82 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. The ancients were divided in their opinions concerning the real nature of the Demiurgus. Some affirmed him to be a devil, because he is an agency that is ever destroying, but does he not wreak destruction in order that reconstruction may follow upon a higher level of manifestation? He is the Lord of death because he controls birth and death, for these phenomena exist nowhere except in the world of forms. Again, some have attributed to him the diabolical genius of a madman who created a nightmare universe where everything is as it should not be. He is the power that binds man to the world of illusion, and in the terms of the early church fathers is the enemy of the eternal God, good. Paraphrasing, however, the statements of Omar, the question may be asked, if he be evil, who placed him there? In Faust, Mephistopheles, the agent of the Demiurgus, is made to say, I am the spirit of negation, part of the power that still works for good while ever scheming ill. Accordingly, the second group of ancient philosophers declared the Demiurgus to be ever adding to the glory of God by demonstrating the insufficiency of the form world. He is therefore not the enemy of good but the eternal contrast to good, necessary that man may realize the perfection of right. Who would know or appreciate good if he had not experienced the lack of it? The Lord of the world is therefore the master who whips man until, unable longer to bear the lashes of unkind destiny, the sufferer revolts against his own insufficiency and thus is directed into the way of light. In antiquity the Lord of the world was well symbolized as the master of the whip and the wielder of the flail. The Egyptian pharaohs carried three scepters symbolic of their authority from the Demiurgus, the Anubis-headed staff, symbolic of the sagacity of the world Lord, the shepherd's crook, symbolic of the priesthood and the authority of the world Lord over the souls of men, and the flail, symbolic of the mastery which the Demiurgus exercises over the bodies of all creatures. Returning to our primitive symbolism, the Anubis-headed Staff is symbolized by the dot, the shepherd's crook by the line, and the flail by the circle. These are representative respectively of rulership through wisdom, rulership through faith, and rulership through force. Thus the dot is now termed government. It was once the crown, but now so large a part of government is administered by the people that the crown can only be used in its abstract sense. The dot, however, signifies government by the state. The line is the tiara, or government by the church. And the circumference is the people who are the beneficiaries of government. Thus we find three tremendous forces continually focused upon the objective life of man, and the poor version of these forces constitutes the threefold fountainhead of evil as opposed to the threefold fountainhead of light. Through the perversion of government we have ignorance. Through the perversion of the church, superstition, and through the perversion of the people, fear. Thus come into existence the great Masonic trio of evils, ignorance, superstition, and fear, the murderers of human liberty and the destroyers of understanding. Although we conceive ourselves to exist in a world amply lighted physically by the sun, and adequately illumined mentally and ethically by philosophy, religion, and science, we actually dwell in a sphere as dark as Egypt's night. There is but one true light in the universe, namely, the light of understanding, a trait in which humanity is woefully deficient. The presence of hope, belief, and fear is definite proof that the world lacks knowledge and adequate spiritual perceptions. The darkness of this underworld is so dense that we cannot perceive the hearts of our fellow men. We cannot sense the motives that inspire our neighbor to action, nor can we pierce the surrounding gloom and see that which lies but a few steps ahead. While humanity sojourns in this underworld of mortal light and spiritual darkness, it is actually passing through an embryonic state. Within the womb of matter, fetal man is being prepared for birth into the greater universe of divine realities. The physical universe may therefore be termed the antechamber of cosmos, the little room with the hole in the floor referred to in the mysteries. As infant man must be carried for the 9 months of the prenatal epoch before his organisms are able to bear exposure to external conditions, so